This is Ron Zimmerman. You're listening to Story Worthy Bumpers.
Welcome to the Story Worthy Podcast. Here are your hosts, Christine Blackburn and Hannes Finney.
Welcome to Storyworthy. I am Christine Blackburn, and I'm here with
Hannes Finney, and we're coming to you from the Marvel Comics Studios in New York City.
You know, it's about time we come from New York, Hannes.
It is, it is. Well, we were banned due to certain legal issues from being in New York. I had certain warrants that were outstanding, but there's no reason to really
well,
go into that.
And you like to come from Wisconsin. That's really what it's all about.
Well, it is. Obviously, it's cheaper for us to fly our private jet with a studio bus attached inside it to a state like Wisconsin. New York, there's a lot of overhead. You know?
The Storyworthy Jet of Truth.
Yes, yes, the Jet of Truth, exactly.
And then the bus, and then so we have the Bus of Truth.
And
within.
We are here because among our guests, many credits are writing for Marvel Comics.
That's
but
right,
not
Ron
entirely.
Zimmerman.
Ron Zimmerman.
He's a comedian, he's a writer, and he's also a producer.
And an actor,
but he might best be known for his Marvel Comics series, Rawhide Kid. Well,
and,
anyway, so,
anyhow,
so Ron Zimmerman's here, and I'm anxious to hear his story. His story is titled The Suicide Kid.
The Suicide Kid.
Before we get into that, I do want to mention, folks.
Speaking of suicide, how about that Twitter?
You know,
today's hectic world, if you're going to commit suicide, you don't have time to write things on a piece of paper and hope it doesn't blow away while your body rots next to it. You got to send out a tweet.
I enjoy the Twitter before I go to bed at night. Like, I go through tweets between, you know, before I go to bed, like at 10 o'clock, 10:30 at night. I'm flipping through. I don't know.
Much like your daughter flipping through the pictures to make herself, you know,
tired.
Just calm herself down.
You
just look at tweets the whole time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Hey, Ron Zimmerman's story called The Suicide Kid. What do I know about suicide? My neighbor committed suicide, but that's about all I know.
Well, like, you
that's
said
all
it was
that
your
really
mom's
was,
neighbor.
It was my, well, where I grew up. Yeah, my childhood neighbor. But it was just last year. So you didn't know
this person.
I knew him growing up, yeah. But he was like maybe 35 now, and he went and got his mother a sandwich at Subway and gave it to her in bed. She was resting, and then he went into the basement and hung himself, you know. So that was that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was saying, of course, as our listeners know, my dad committed suicide.
Right.
You know, this is many, many, many years ago, and I won't bore you with the whole story again, but basically you were talking about this woman and your neighbor, and she goes down and she finds him. Say, suicide is ultimate selfishness.
Right.
Is what it really is.
Because now, this, like, in my circumstance, my friend's circumstance, my neighbor woman, she's like 70 years old, and she goes and sees her son hanging there and, like, trying to grab his legs and lift him up, and, you know, this is her hell, and he's already gone.
Right. So if you are old enough that your parents are elderly, you need to kill them first, as Woody Allen said in, there was a great movie, he said. He was going to commit suicide, but it was kill his parents, so he'd have to kill them first. It'd be a bloodbath, and so he decides not to kill himself. Oh, what the hell movie is that? Hannah and Her Sisters?
I love that movie.
Oh, God, it's one of my favorites.
Okay, so the point is...
Suicide bad, in case you needed us to tell you that.
Right, we know this. But the good news is our guest tonight, Ron Zimmerman, he obviously is not successful at this venture.
Not so far, but he's not going to be up for like 2 or 3 minutes, so it could all fall apart in the next, between your living room and our recording space.
I don't think so. He seems like a completely reasonable man.
He's got a cat, he's got a hat.
And a jaunty scarf.
Yeah.
Okay, so Suicide Kid, we're just going to hear what Ron Zimmerman has to say.
This is a topic that needs details.
But
it needs fill-in spaces.
But I will say, Hannes, your story about your father is fascinating. And what didn't we talk about?
Even suicide, was normal. My dad had not talked to my mom in years and years and years, then calls her and says the CIA was bugging their bedroom and all sorts of really crazy shit. So she tells me this, and I'm like, awesome. Turns out he's not just being an asshole, he's crazy. So then I'm going and I'm doing stand-up basically for the first time in a class about humor and literature. And then when I go back, you know, sometime during that week, then I go back and find his body. And it's like, probably, you know, it's just like, really? Do I have to do stand-up, which is one of the most important things in my life, the same week?
So you went to his apartment?
Yes.
And you had a key to his apartment because you didn't
I had to get the landlord to open the door.
I see.
And
Were you hesitant at that time when you couldn't get a hold of him? Did you think there might be a problem here?
Yeah. Yeah. I thought there might be a problem. I mean, I don't.
What do you do at that moment?
Yes, go, fuck me. That's what I do. And I'm sitting outside and I'm like, okay, how am I going to tell my schizophrenic brother? Who, of course, then walks up at that moment because he lived about a block away. And I'm like, hey, guess what? Dad's inside and he's dead. And then we call. Well, what
you
am I supposed
that.
To? Well, I don't know. I said something like that. What am I supposed to sit him down and give him coffee?
I don't know.
I'm sitting on a lawn of a house I've never been to before because I'd never been.
So
to
you
the...
saw him in the room, in the bedroom?
Yeah, it was. No, it was a very small apartment. It may have even been a studio. He was like being a teaching assistant at the university again. And no, I didn't actually go in the room. I just saw his feet and I smelled it.
Mm.
And
so
it's probably been
around.
Dead for a week or something.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa, that's
so
heavy.
Yeah, it's heavy. And then so then we call the police and it literally takes them an hour to get there. We had to like call again and then they came right away. So obviously there was like a mix up
that's
between.
That's terrible. And your brother still lives in Milwaukee?
Yes, yes, yes.
And he doesn't have any more family there or anything, right? No more family
besides
him.
I have some cousins outside Milwaukee about 45 minutes. I don't think they see him very much.
Mm.
So, all right.
All right, now
all right,
for
so,
the comedy stylings
now,
of.
All right, and if you haven't driven off a bridge while listening to this on your iPad.
Hey, it's called The Suicide Kid. I mean, you know, he brought the title. I didn't say, hey, Ron, want to talk about suicide? He says, hey, Christine, here's the title.
Yeah, by
so
the way, Suicide Worthy was the original name of this podcast.
That's exactly
and it was
right.
Hard to get traction.
All suicide all the time.
Ah, that's true. That's
folks,
true
wherever
enough.
You are, stay tuned because Ron Zimmerman is on his way here.
Storyworthy tweets. So join us on Twitter and be our friend on Facebook.
Hi, this is Phil Hendry. You're listening to the Storyworthy podcast with Christine Blackburn and Hannes Thinney. We'll be right back.
Back, we've left the Marvel Comics studio and now we're outside of DC Comics studio. We're not inside, we're just giving them the finger because our Joe Slepsky, he loves Marvel and our guest wrote for Marvel, so we're just saying, hey, DC, hey, fuck you. You think you're cool? You're not cool.
Wow,
fuck you. Too much.
Wow, well,
now,
I don't
probably
have that
by
anger,
the way,
but...
our guest is about to sign a contract with DC to be the new Superman guy, and I just fucked that up. Oh, wait, nobody listens to this. Never mind.
That's all right. All right, you guys, he's here right now, Ron Zimmerman. He's a comic, a writer, and a producer. He's also a friend and an associate of Howard Stern. He used to be on that show. And you know, Hannes, I'm a huge fan of Howard Stern. You know that.
You are. I mean, I, of course, also like the Howard Stern. But you actually paid for the, I could not afford the satellite.
Satellite.
You had satellite.
Exactly right. All right, let's see what else is going on. He is a writer, like I said, has written for all sorts of shows, Hannes. Some shows that we've got to do, we just have to get into, like Charles in Charge, like you mentioned. He also is, let's see here. Oh, well, actually, right now, he is currently working on a project with Cher, who he may or may not be dating. We'll find out. Ladies and gentlemen, wherever you are, put your hands together for Ron Zimmerman.
Suicide is painful. Part one. When a person commits suicide, it's a terrible thing. When a person tries and fails to commit suicide, it's just foolish. I am just such a fool. The veteran of at least 6 failed suicide attempts and at least a dozen more plots, plans, schemes, and scenarios to do away with my greatest enemy, my arch nemesis, the thorn that will not leave my side, me. It's 1967, and I have just turned 9 years old. Batman, Bonanza, and Star Trek are my favorite shows, and my mother, a first-class, idiot, has given me a party I didn't want, ask for, or am capable of enjoying. A boy named Greg Bernstein, who is not my friend, but my mother's friend's son, keeps running up and referring to himself as Greg Bernstein, as if he's narrating his own life. This is such a great party, and Greg Bernstein is having a really neat time. When he meets other kids, he doesn't say, "Hi, I'm Greg," or even, "Hi, I'm Greg Bernstein," but, "Hi, you're meeting me, Greg Bernstein." I can tell that there is something seriously wrong with Greg Bernstein, but I was very self-involved even at 9 and didn't care much or long, and will not be mentioning him again in this story, and I'm a little sorry I already did. As the party raged, kids ran around eating cake, yelling at the wind, and chasing their tails. That's how I remember kids, human puppies chasing their tails with no real purpose beyond amusing themselves to no end. I sat in the den in a big flat, light beige chair that my dad used to spend a lot of time looking unhappy in, thinking about what I would be doing with myself once these human puppy people were picked up by their owners and taken home. The answer was nothing. I would be doing nothing because there was nothing to do. My life was meaningless, and I decided this very day worth absolutely nothing to me, and if it meant anything to anyone else, they were stupid or lying. I lived with 3 people I'm indifferent to, and most of the time I feel like if I smile, my head will crack and fall off into rubble at my feet. My mother is a yappy cluck given to strangely erotic flirtations with my older brother Andy, who I will get to in a minute. My mother likes to talk about sex. She likes to talk about having it with men. It could be my father, her cousins, the mailman, the delivery boy, pretty much anyone with a penis, but more often than not, it's my brother, her son, which is just real nice, isn't it? I call this emotional incest. I don't think my mother and my brother ever did anything, but my mother liked to at least verbally explore the idea that her 12-year-old son might like to. My father is Sonny. Sonny is a cool guy, and as far as I can tell, his biggest problem is he is attracted to a woman that likes to make her son think about fucking her. I do not know Sonny's mom. Her name was Grandma Bess, but I have a hunch she was not very good. My dad is rarely home, citing business trips, which I certainly understand and even admire, because our home is a terrible place to be, and any excuse to leave it sits fine with me. When he is there, he's always in a foul humor and quite terrifying, which I also understand and admire. Then there's my older brother, Andy, who is without a doubt or peer the single most stupid, ignorant waste of flesh and bones I have ever met. It would be 30 years before I understood that he was simply what he was programmed to be, a tool of my parents. But at the time I did, the money it cost me in therapy to learn this only made me hate him more, which I now know says bad things about me and my shrink. And my only defense here is that the guy still is a fucking ignoramus, no matter who pointed him in that direction. My only true friend in the family is Whiskey, the dog, not the drink. My mother says that without fail anytime she introduces the pooch, and she always cracks herself up when she does. Naming the dog Whiskey was the result of an entire day of brainstorming. I guess the idea was, since Dad drank lots of it, and we could all pronounce it, and words like booze and whiskey elicited gales of laughter in the Matt Helm is the greatest movie ever made world I came of age in, it was just too perfect. Back to my 9th birthday party. After a while, all my little dunderhead puppy people friends were gone. I continued to sit in my dad's big chair and stare numbly out the window. My mom came up and sat in the identical leather chair across the glass coffee table from me. I mentioned the table because we had one, so stop expecting one of those awful Danny Thomas stories. This gets plenty bad enough without dragging that poor bastard into it. But every time I hear the words glass top table, okay, see, now I'm doing it. Back to 1967. My mom asked what was wrong. Was I ill? Did I need to go to the bathroom? This was always the only problem that idiot brother Andy had ever suffered from, and for him, it was the truth, and as the firstborn, he seemed to have set the benchmark for what could go wrong with a human boy. Andy was a person who never had anything wrong with him besides having to shit and torturing everyone around him with silent gas. He seemed to revel in endlessly passing to alert all within a country mile of the impending movements of his bowels. Of course, he was too stupid to even shit without being told. He could not do the math between gas and shit, so there wasn't a chance he would ever become upset about anything based on reflection. No, Andy's problems were all addressed with one solution: shit. My mom, of course, didn't call shit shit or any other reliable names for human byproduct. We didn't get poop or duty, not crap or poo, not number two or caca. My mom had her own word for it that was no doubt passed down from her, and this explains a little bit. Norfolk, Virginia, racist, drawling, gambling, lying, cheating, Jewish, Southern parents. Scum, to be sure. We were raised on tink. That's right, tink. Andy, do you have to tink? This was the clarion call around our house. I guess tink was meant to be some sort of weighted version of tinkle. Apparently, in her family's pea brains, pea was tinkle, so shit must be basically the same word, because these people were so ignorant, I imagine they feared running out of words. So the decision must have been made that if we simply add gravity to a tinkle and make it tink, we will have a name for shit without having to use up extra valuable words we may need later for something else. I guess they thought they might invent something and want to call it shit. Perhaps my Grandpa George was worried that in between losing all our family's money at the track, hawking his wife's sister's jewelry, and triple mortgaging all our homes, he might light on that cancer cure he was no doubt working on, and he'd have to call it something and was saving the word shit for the occasion. Whatever the case, in our house, it was called tink. The perfect end to this digression is that, of course, as if to defy even a hint of logic or sense, my mother didn't call tinkle tinkle. She called tinkle TT. So even the theory I made up to try to give these people something resembling rhyme or reason is blown to bits. My life was tink and TT, and on my 9th birthday, I announced to my mother, after assuring her I didn't have to tink, that instead my problem was that I felt I had no hope and could not find any reason whatsoever to continue living, that life seemed to be nothing but pain and hardship, and from what I could surmise at age 9, it got only worse, not better. I said, I hate the quality of my life and would rather not go on with any more of it. They didn't beat me or each other. There were plenty of worse homes than my bad one. This wasn't an emotional decision. This was just a matter of good sense. I knew life was difficult and full of pain and hardship at 9, so why participate in such an endeavor as I grew older? I understood very early on the concept of diminishing returns, and it would still be 4 more years before my dermatologist raped me, but that's another suicide attempt story for another day. Well, as you can imagine, Mom was very sympathetic and seemed positive that a good tink might change my attitude. But it didn't. No amount of tink could persuade me that life was worth living, and so a few weeks later I began plotting my own murder. Near the glamorous Rockville Mall in gray Rockville, Maryland, a slow train ran through the outskirts of the slower town through a gully near our garden apartment complex. The plan was simple. I would stand in the center of the hill between myself and the oncoming train, and when I saw its nose round the corner, just run. Run for my death. And so I did. I saw the giant train nose round the bend, and off I went to end it all by hurling myself in front of the oncoming locomotive. I miscalculated, of course, being a boy with the blood of Wabash, Indiana, and Norfolk, Virginia, ignorant hybrid Jewish hicks running through my veins, and missed being splattered to the winds by the gaping mouth of the train, and instead hit the side and bounced off back up the hill like a pebble in a hurricane. My knee was shattered, some ribs, and my nose broken, and thanks to my death not beginning, my life was over. I crawled up the hill, eventually was found and taken to the hospital. I told anyone who cared, which wasn't anyone for very long, that I had been chasing my ball and simply ran into the train, what with being so focused on my athletic pursuits. Not only was this story not questioned, but it was applauded because it evidenced the end of a frightening, potentially burgeoning homosexual lack of interest in sports. The story was a fine one, one to be proud of. Ron was hit by a train playing ball. That's what boys do, right? He was simply being a normal boy. I'll say this. The experience taught me that to succeed in doing away with my most hated enemy, me, I would have to be a little more clever next time. And as I lay in the room I shared with Andy, stranded in bed, healing from my sports injuries and suffocating from his odious stench, I knew and swore to myself there would most certainly be a next time. To be continued.
You know, honestly, when I heard that you hit the train and bounced off, in my head I thought to myself, well, good for you. I mean, did you? And I thought exactly what you're saying, that they applauded you like you're a hero.
Yes.
But you beat a train.
Well, yes and no. No, I was
well, they're
a
more excited about the fact that you were chasing this fictitious ball.
I was a hero for showing interest in sports.
Right, exactly. But you made it all up. So you were producing and writing scenarios in your head at 9 years old.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So did you
this, by the way, sounds like one of the greatest Lifetime movies ever. You should need to write this up.
Did you really think, what, 6 years old, what was the suicide thought?
No, I didn't have suicide thoughts, but I was writing stories.
Oh, okay. At nine, this was the suicide attempt at the train. Did you really think you would end your life? Did you even know what that meant?
Absolutely.
But how did you know? Did you know anybody who had died?
No, I had probably seen it on TV or, you know, something that there was, you know, we used to watch Mod Squad quite a bit.
Right, I remember that.
So there was like drug overdoses.
The Mod Squad was Link.
Pete and Julie.
Pete and Julie. Link was short for Lincoln.
Oddly enough, his original name in the pilot, Tink. Just in case. And they decided since he was the black one, that was a bad idea.
They did. And this was all in Maryland where you...
Well, it ended up after nine, it divided between Maryland and Indiana.
No, God.
So glamorous and more glamorous.
Where I'm moving back to.
Is that right?
In April for a few months anyway.
To Indiana, or to Maryland?
To Indiana.
What part of Indiana? I'm from Wisconsin.
Wabash, Indiana.
Is that the Wabash Cannonball?
Wabash
Cannonball. That's the thing. Yep. And are you shooting there? Are you working there?
No, I'm going there not to shoot, work, or think about show business.
What will you do
anything. There? I'm going to fish and hang out with the very few the only relatives I really have.
What kind of fishing is it?
I have no idea. There's.
It's called dynamite fishing.
You know,
toss it in, and
in the Great Lakes Midwest, mm-hmm. you probably know that there's like a million lakes in every state.
Right.
So you know, and everybody fishes and hunts and does all that.
Yeah, fishing is often just an excuse for beer drinking.
Well, it's a meditation
outside the house.
It's just a way. You know, I like to just get in one of those little outboard fishing boats and go and just cruise
around.
Yeah, you know, you just think and stuff. I mean, I'm sure. Well, I was a butcher when I was a kid, so I do know how to. I mean, if I caught a fish, I would only catch it to eat it, but probably I would throw it back.
Well, why were you a butcher as a child? That's very unusual.
I quit high school at a tender age.
15, 16?
14.
No kidding. You stopped going to high school at 14 years old?
I stopped going to high school like before high school started.
At the end of junior high. Did you end up getting a GED and go farther? Or what?
I took the GED and the only thing I passed in it was English, and everything else I failed. So
to this day,
I didn't even get the GED.
Okay, so boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, here's a great example of...
drop out of school, do
forget
it.
Forget this whole education
You'll
thing.
You'll become a butcher and then a Hollywood writer. The progression is obvious.
You know, I'm kind of a, you know, I'm a kind of smart, stupid guy.
You know. How did you get to New York from Maryland and Indiana? How did you choose?
Stand-up was the actually, and in a certain sense, Howard.
How did you meet Howard?
He was doing his show in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
when I was, the first time I did stand-up in D.C.
Wow.
Which I did because I lost a bet with somebody, and they had an open mic night in 1979 of like, maybe even 78. And he used to go do his show and then he started hanging out at what was this new comedy club. So I went on and he was in the back and after I was done, he came up to me and you know, said, "Hey, you were funny." And I said, "Thanks." And he said, you kind of got like an Andy Kaufman, white Richard Pryor thing for you there. And I was like, "Wow, you know, thanks." And then I ended up, he asked me if I wanted to come and be on his show.
Now, would you have say that was part of the Whack Pack or no? You were just kind of like,
no,
on it. It wasn't that part of it.
No, it was before anything. It was just him and Rob.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, this is before the National.
I mean,
this
Gary,
New York, even.
Yeah. Yeah. Gary was there, I guess, but it was really like him and Robin and I just, you know, went in the studio and I know he was like all over that 5 second button.
Oh, right.
Because I had no idea what I was doing. You know, I was, right. I think I was maybe 17 or 18.
That is unbelievable.
And you know, and he was like 28 or something.
Right.
And so I had no idea about the radio or anything. You know, I knew I wanted to be in show business.
What an introduction to, I mean, who would have known at the time how iconic that was?
Yeah. Well, right. It was like, hey, this cool guy, you know, and I met his wife and his kid.
I mean,
had little
like
kids
even Private Parts, you know, his movie, I think it went up to like 92 was when the movie, you know, it was a period of time, his movie. And it was so beautiful, the beginning. And I mean, it was just such a beautiful story. Yeah. And so that's what you were in the very beginning of that.
Like, right. So how much
it's so
time?
So honest.
I remember you were part of the, you know, transitioning, like who's going to take over for the Joke Man. So
Jackie,
how long did that go on?
I was there like 6 weeks.
Yeah.
When Jackie quit, Howard called and said, "I'm, I'm freaking out, and you know, we got the empty chair. It's driving me crazy. And you know, could you come here and just hang out for a while?
Yeah. He just needs like a buffer.
Just sit in Jackie's chair. You know, if you want to work, you can work. If you want to just talk, you do whatever you want. I just need somebody in that chair and, you know, that'll say jokes and somebody I like, you know. So, you know, we'll put you up and pay, blah, blah, blah." So I went and really, I went because I thought it'd be interesting. And also, I thought that I could get Jackie back on.
Oh, interesting. You
Jackie's
were friends
a
with
friend
him.
Of mine, too.
I see.
And so I was, like, hanging out with Jackie after the shows. And I hated doing it. I mean,
so you weren't
miserable.
Trying to be your own man or your own talent. You were just trying to pass off the word that Jackie should come back.
Not even. I mean, my plan to get Jackie back, and later on, we found out it would have. Howard was like, "Yeah, you know,
he would have fell for it."
He was like, "That's what it." Yeah, if he'd have done that,
wow,
would have been fine.
Wow.
Because my thing with Jackie was we'd walk around the park, and I go, "Jackie, here's what you do. You want your job back?" "Yeah, I feel kind of bad about it." And you know, this is like 6 weeks of, I go, "You know, you have a certain window of time that this is going to work. But tomorrow morning, show up."
Yeah.
Walk in. And I said, you know, do the old, you know,
put your game face on.
The unwritten rule of Hollywood, of show business, of all of show business is it never happened. I go, you know, Howard knows this rule.
Mm-hmm.
You walk in, you show up. I said, you tell me.
It's kind of like when Jay Leno came back with The Tonight Show. It's like Conan O'Brien.
Never happened.
And everybody was like, "Oh, we're so upset." 3 minutes into Jay Leno's return show, everybody was like, Yeah, fucking Conan, completely forgot everything
Conan
that happened.
Conan is raging, and you know, and Jay's is, what?
Right.
What? It never happened, you know. And
yeah,
I said,
yeah.
I said, if you want to go, you want your job back, tell me. I won't go in tomorrow morning. Show up, sit in your chair.
Yeah, and at the very least, know, Howard Stern, who loved confrontation on the radio, said, would have it, even said, if just to argue or yell at him, would have put him on the air.
I said, Howard's going to get a week of huge ratings and great shows if you just show up, just by him and Robin going, get out of here, you
right,
quit.
Just by
you're
being
not
there.
Allowed to be. And I said, just show up, you'll start working again. And you know, he did not understand the words of the great Bob Dylan, who once sang, "Swallow your pride; it's not poison."
Wow!
And so like he was too prideful to go back.
Right.
That's because I remember listening at that time. He was on the air in L.A. out here. He was on the air in a lot of the country. It's like, dude, you don't leave that gig.
To me,
he made himself the Fredo of the family.
To me, it says he didn't want it enough. He didn't want it enough to play the game. You know, he needed to play.
But what was the game? I don't recall
exactly.
Well,
it was just to not skulk away, but to just show back up and take the beating he deserved. As it were. I mean, let Howard do his thing and then move on. Something else will come along. When did Artie then show up?
It was quite a while later. Then I had the idea because I wanted out of there so bad. You know, I couldn't get used to getting
Isn't
up
that
early.
And,
you know, I mean, the second day I was there, I had to drink just to come up at 6 a.m.
Yeah.
So I would tell I told the kid, you know, here's my orange juice. Okay, it's half vodka. Go out, buy. Here's money. Buy it when you. Because he'd be like, "You want anything for breakfast?" I'm like, yeah,
right.
Some French toast. Now, the other thing I need you to do.
Right.
Buy half pint of vodka. Dump it out. Buy half orange juice, vodka. Dump half the orange juice out. Fill the vodka up. The second day on the show, the station manager comes in. I'm busted.
Yeah.
I thought you can't smell vodka.
You can't, but the I don't know, somehow the kid ratted me out or whatever, and the stage manager comes in the day two, and goes, "Hey Howard, your Hollywood buddy that's come to help you out, he's drunk.
This is great entertainment."
And Howard, of course, is just like
terrific.
You know, he is not. Come on, it's 6 a.m. Yeah. You know, what kind of an idiot is drunk at 6 a.m.?
You are.
And I'm shit-faced. And the guy, you know, then it becomes, you know, a whole segment of, let me taste the oranges. No, get away from the oranges.
Right. You know, this is so great.
Hiding it.
Yeah, I was such a, because then back then he was on terrestrial radio and you could hear him everywhere.
Yeah.
And then it's 6 weeks of you know, me walking around Manhattan, you know, somehow from the E! Show, you know. Uh-huh. And it's like, hey, you're the drunk friend.
Right,
you know?
Right. So now all of a sudden you're like Hank the Angry Dwarf, and then there's Ron the alcoholic.
Yeah. And
it's very interesting that you weren't, you know, that you didn't really want to be there, because there's so many huge Howard Stern fans now and back then.
Yeah.
I mean, every little thing he says on the show is dissected online. Yeah. And so you were like a major character in his world, and you didn't even want to be there.
No, I mean, you know, I mean, I love Howard. I mean, he's like, you know,
he's prophetish, prophet-like.
I mean, he's just my, you know, he's a dear, dear friend. He's like a relative.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I knew Allison and his kids when they were little kids. You know, I've grown up and I've, you know, he's just like a person that's been in my life.
Yeah, since you were 17, so, that's like a kid.
It's well over half my life.
Right.
I mean, 3/4 of my life, I've been friends with this guy. So, you know, I mean, I'm amazed at his, you know, at his success, but I know a lot of people that are real successful.
Oh,
so,
I understand that. Well,
you know, it's just my career has been an odd one in that I've been around a lot of famous people. So,
well, now you're bringing this up.
I'm not jaded, but
you're bringing this up. You are working with Cher right now on a new project.
Yeah.
About Hollywood in the 60s, I understand.
Yeah.
And so that sounds like a lot of fun.
So it's like a series.
The costumes alone,
series.
I love
just
that.
I'm writing a pilot.
Okay, cool.
And we'll see.
And it's on Logo TV?
So far.
Okay, so they've connected you guys.
Well, we
you can tell us anything. No one listens to this.
Duh.
We, yeah, you can just lie if you want to.
They came to us. And, yeah. And you know, they like, you know, of course, you know, it's the gay network. So, you know, if they can get even a commercial with
Cher
going.
She has a huge following.
You know, I mean, her alone will sort of put them into, you know, the big kids' tables.
Yes.
And they're just starting original programming and you know, they were fans of this show I did called Action.
Mm-hmm.
And of course they loved the Rawhide Kid because it was about a gay cowboy. So
right. And so the Rawhide Kid was a gay comic book character.
The first gay comic book character.
And what year was
he
that?
He had existed before, and then the reinvention
I took a character that was popular in the late 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And Marvel said, you want to write comic books from when? Because they heard me on Howard's show.
Mm-hmm.
This is all like 10 years ago.
How did they know you liked comic books?
Me and Howard would talk about it on the show. So then they called and said, you want to write some books? I was like, sure. What do you want to do? And I said, well, I've been trying to sell a Western, you know, TV show for years. I love Westerns. Okay, well, you want to do a Western? Yeah. And then I was like, well, what character of our old Western characters do you have? And I took the best one, the Rawhide Kid. And they were like, okay, what are you going to do to make him, you know, different, you know, sort of relevant? And I said, you know, me and my editor sort of spun stuff around and came up with he's gay. You know, he's the toughest guy, the fastest gun, the coolest guy.
Now, what year
the biggest,
is this at this time?
It's about 11, 10 years ago.
Okay, that's
it was
pretty
right
progressive.
When the, it was, I just remember it was when the war started, because on the CNN crawl, it was like, we're at war. And after that, Marvel publishes first gay comic character. And like, you know, all the, you know, Leno and Letterman. I mean, everybody's doing Rawhide Kid jokes for,
right.
you know, that news cycle week. And so it was, you know, it was funny
who illustrated those?
The guy that did it back in the 50s and 60s, you know, like the original guy came out of retirement.
Wow.
He was 86 years old to illustrate the first graphic.
So how did he take to the new gayness?
Loved
of the,
it.
Yeah, what
he
was
just
the
loved it. It was a comedy,
there?
You know. I mean, it wasn't like a gay thing. It was a comedy.
So what was the process? You met with him?
No, I never met him. I wrote a script, just like writing a movie script. And then, because I didn't really know how to write comic books, I knew how to write scripts. So I said, if I write a script, yeah, fine. And then the editor takes it and turns it into
the format.
You don't have all the creative control, of course. It's just you're the writer on the project.
I mean, you know, and obviously I wouldn't give, you know, this guy is like, his name is John Severin, and, you know, he's a legendary artist.
Wow.
So I would never, you know, say anything. And he drew it beautifully.
Aren't you? That was really exciting.
It was.
Have you written any comic books since?
Yeah, I did. I did like a, you know, Spider-Man, you know, like sort of special things. I did like three kind of mini series and two became graphic novels and one nobody understood and never became anything.
Oh, what was that? Or did that even
it
get
was
published?
Called, yeah, I mean, it was published as comic books.
Yeah.
They just never did a, you know, it was called Get Craven. And it was about Hollywood. It was a satire of Hollywood because I'd done a show called Action with Jay Moore.
Yeah, which I was just looking at. Jay Moore
Douglas.
Was the star of that. I remember that show. I remember. Yeah, so he was like a Hollywood agent kind of guy.
Producer.
The producer. So how was the, did you pay any attention to the, you know, critical response or all the websites? Because comic books, I know, I'm like,
oh, they
just
tear
enough of a
your
nerd.
Ass apart.
I'm just enough of a nerd to like understand,
you know,
that
what?
They exist. And I look every once a year.
I did it like
some people live for this.
One
stuff.
Weekend, I went on those sites and people were so mean. And I spent the whole weekend actually getting in fights with people.
Oh, you responded.
I responded to everything.
Oh, well, there you go. That's your problem
then,
right there.
And it was like, it was just a nightmare. And Joe Quesada, who was the, you know, the chief of Marvel, called me after one weekend of me like going, you know, writing stuff like, let me tell you some asshole, you know, I will go anywhere in America and meet you in a parking lot.
You did not.
And kick your ass, you motherfucker. And he finally calls me and he's like, you know, some of these people you're writing are like nine, you know?
Did you stop? Have you? You don't read anymore. Thank goodness.
Never again, because after that, my sales just went plummeted.
Oh my goodness. And he says,
and he goes, you are now the single most hated writer in the history of comic books.
Wow.
They hate your
guts.
Those
are huge words.
Yeah.
It's okay, we were talking about this before. It reminded me of this thing. I just have to quote this thing from The Simpsons where I was saying last year, Lisa's saying something to the comic book guy about, didn't Fallout Boy die or something? He goes, well, that was in a special alternate universe, so that never actually happened. And she looks around the comic store and goes, you know, none of this ever actually happened. And he goes, get out of my store. And it's like, that's the, yes. And I said that to our friend Joe here, who is a big comic book guy. And he said, I agree with the comic book. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Get
out of the store.
Story like that, that I know I don't have time to tell, but it's very similar.
Another question I want to ask you before we wrap this up.
And by the way, the reason I went with, when I was a kid.
Okay.
Howard told me about comedy. He said, what you do to make comedy is when everybody else takes a right, you take a left.
I love that. Let me ask you, on his show, did it ever get tiring or was it ever, you know, tedious, the amount of women that came through and got undressed? I mean, did that ever get like uncomfortable what was that like?
You know, I got in fights with them. So like I couldn't get along with the porn stars. I couldn't get along. I did not get along.
Because you were drunk?
No, because I thought it was pathetic. And I would say, why don't you just like get a job with some dignity? You know, and Howard would goad me into it because he liked me to fight with these whores and strippers and stuff. And I would go, you know, come on, you're pathetic. And she goes, you know, and then the girls are going, ah, fuck you, you know, you idiot. Where's Jackie, you know?
Yeah, but this had to have been fun. And you're telling me you didn't want to be there.
It was interesting, but you know, again, it's like, you know, it's so early in the morning. I'm a night person.
You're a writer.
I've done some early.
At heart, you're a writer, it sounds like.
Yeah.
I mean, you've done a lot of things, but it seems like at heart
I like to perform, but...
On your own terms.
At night.
But, you know, and yes, also, Howard keeps a very...
specific.
He choreographs, you know, he's like Count Basie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he is the conductor of the show.
Right.
So you can be talking for 2 minutes, and Howard has the sound... has your sound off? And he's like doing a commercial, you know, and you don't even know until he goes, you're not even on, you know.
I think he's like, he would be like watching an artist. Almost.
It is. That's what I'm saying. He's like Duke Ellington or Count Basie. Any great, you know, the most brilliant conductors is what Howard does. He conducts every guest, everything. He's got that control board. He hits things that he has jokes being written that are on a little...
a scroll or something?
No, they're on little three screens, like using the Johnny Carson technique of cue cards, which is to have one, and one, so it never looks like you're not looking at everybody in the room.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I love that.
Which Johnny Carson invented, you know. And Howard does it, but he has little screens, and there's somebody... Well, me, it was Jackie for, you know, 15 years. And they give you they have one of these, and there's a box, and they put, there's a box of blank paper and a huge cup of Sharpies.
Right.
The minute the show starts, it's up like this. The minute the show starts, you listen to Howard, and as he's talking, you're grabbing paper and you're writing a joke on the thing.
Putting it under a camera, which shows up on his screen.
Right.
As quick as can be.
As fast as can be. And there's times where he's talking to you, like he's in, you know, he's making fun of you, and you're writing jokes for him to say about you, but you're defending yourself at the same time.
Yeah.
It's
It's like, sounds it, like it'd be so, you'd really so, be in the moment.
Your head is, you know, when exploding. It's over. You just like awesome. Sleep. I need sleep.
Draining.
My brain is exploding. You know, and he's, I'm gonna go work out. You know, and it's like you just can't think another thought. You know, I would say to Jackie, you know, Jesus, you know, you like your act sucks so bad and all those terrible jokes and everything, but what you've been doing for him is fucking genius, man. Yeah. Because I don't know, I couldn't do that. I said I can barely get through 1 week of this.
Keep up, yeah.
And I'm losing my mind.
Do you miss New York at all?
Hated New York.
Hated New York. You happy in LA?
No. Well, I have been, but now I've decided it's time to just I
go back east for a while.
I want to go. You're going to the small Wabash. Town and yeah. I just want to see a different lifestyle.
Okay, we'll see in about 2 weeks. I give it 2 weeks.
It could well be. I mean, I've said, you know, I rented a house for 3 months.
Oh, wow, that's a good amount of time.
But I have like 3 acres and, you know, it's the biggest lot in the whole town and you know.
So you'll be like, king of the mountain, you know, king of the mountain.
Is you think you're going to get away from show business and every farmer in town with a screenplay is going to show up at your door.
That's okay. That's why I have dogs.
But it's like it just reminds me on a very different scale of like I go back to Milwaukee and for one first day, I'm like, this is nice. Second day, I'm like, I could live here. Third day, I'm like, get me the fuck out of here.
Well, yeah, it's
nice to have you. So we'll see. Yeah, like you said.
You know, it's like I've been here since 1986, and I have driven the furthest I've driven since 1986 is Ojai.
Wow, that's like 90 miles north. That's it. Yeah, not even 60 miles north.
I've never driven out of the state.
Okay,
I rarely travel.
You're a California boy.
I never, you know, I mean, I'm a nester.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, we're glad you nested in California.
I just I've stayed here and just worked and worked and worked and
you have worked. You've got a tremendous body of work.
And then, you know, and now it's like I'm so sick of this. I just want to get out of here.
Okay,
you know?
So go take a break. So go take a break.
To Wabash.
I want to go fishing.
All right.
There we go.
We got to wrap this up. Listen, we do want to thank a couple of people, including Jorge Reyes. He's a sound engineer, you know, Hannes.
Yeah, yes.
Also, John Thomas Griffith, you know, that's the guy.
Never heard of him.
He wrote the theme song Follow Me. And, of course, Joe Slutsky, he helps us out each and every week. And we're going to wrap this up. So thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Ron Zimmerman, we're thrilled that you were here.
Yes, thank you.
This was fun.
Cool. And on behalf of our storyteller tonight, Ron Zimmerman, and, of course, you, Hannes Finney, my co-host.
Me.
I am Christine Blackburn saying, make it a story-worthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Story Worthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Story Worthy on iTunes and visit the Story Worthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schleichinger, I've been friends with her for 10 years, one of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore because it's here and it's funny. And I love you.